1, 2, 3, 4.
How can we ensure that AI is aligned with human values? What can AI teach us about human cognition and creativity?
Dr. Raphael Millier is an assistant professor in philosophy of AI at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. His research primarily explores the theoretical foundations and inner workings of AI systems based on deep learning, such as large language models. He investigates whether these systems can exhibit human-like cognitive capacities, drawing on theories and methods from cognitive science. He is also interested in how insights from studying AI might shed new light on human cognition. Ultimately, his work aims to advance our understanding of both artificial and natural intelligence.
Raphael Millier, welcome to The Creative Process.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Before we get into these complex issues of consciousness and AI and the risks, challenges, and opportunities, who is Raphael Millier? How do you define your sense of self? What makes you who you are, your perception? How do you know you're conscious?
Well, so I can tell you who I am in terms of what I do or what my profession is. So I'm a lecturer in the philosophy of AI at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia, and I'm a philosopher by training. I've moved around quite a bit during my graduate studies and then my early career. Now, you're asking quite a deep question. How do I know who I am on a deeper level? That's the kind of question that I discuss with my students when we talk about consciousness and the self. And I think there is no straightforward answer. What I like to say, what I have argued in my own work, is that the sense of self is not a single thing. There are different ways in which we are conscious of ourselves in ordinary experience. That includes some very sophisticated forms of self-consciousness, like the way in which we are capable of thinking of ourselves as such. If I have thoughts about myself, the kind of person I am, that's a kind of sophisticated cognitive form of self-consciousness that involves something like a concept of self. And that's something that perhaps some non-human animals or perhaps even human infants don't have or don't have in a fully developed way. But there are also some more basic forms of self-consciousness that are part of our ordinary sense of self, including bodily self-consciousness, the kind of awareness we have of our own bodies as being part of ourself. And this is something that presumably young infants and non-human animals can also have, and that's pretty amazing. Might be quite important for their own survival because you have to distinguish between the external environment and your own body in order to navigate the world. So that would be a very short and high-level answer to your very thorny question about what exactly the sense of self is.
Yes. And, you know, I just want to get into how we apply AI to our daily lives, because it's happening whether we put up barriers or we don't engage. It's really hard to avoid. I think, like a lot of people, was relieved when the EU AI Act was passed. Finally, guardrails are being put in place. Of course, it's a question of how we implement those. We're going to have governance. But for those who don't know, they've identified the high risk areas on local, national, and international levels in a variety of fields, from public service management, law enforcement, healthcare. I know you've written about that. And they've established the concept of the human guarantee, financial sector. You've written a lot in your research about the different risk areas, robotics, autonomous vehicles, the military, and the national security. In your research, you explore the vulnerabilities of these systems to be gamed by bad actors, even if there is regulation, since we still don't understand exactly how AI works. So what are your thoughts on the vulnerabilities of those high-risk areas and the kind of pre-training limits that we need to put in place?
Right. So I think there are different categories of potential harms that might result from AI in general. And of course, when we say AI, we have to keep in mind that the way in which we use this term these days encompasses a lot of different technologies, broadly speaking, what's known as deep learning in AI research, which is a method to train these artificial neural networks, very loosely inspired by the brain, to learn from a lot of data automatically, to then be able to perform various tasks, including in the case of large language models like ChatGPT and other chatbots, being trained on a lot of text data. So I think we should always keep in mind that AI as a blanket phrase is a bit of a misnomer, or at least a bit of a simplification, because we have to be clear about exactly which kind of algorithm, which kind of technology we're talking about. But I will say that there are some harms that are, you know, perhaps the gravest potential harms, not so that are immediate, but harms that people are envisioning in the medium to long term. That would include, in the most dramatic potential scenarios, the kind of doomsday scenario that some people have been envisioning with much more advanced AI systems essentially threatening the continued existence of humanity. And these are fairly, in my opinion, still far-fetched, if not science fictional scenarios. So I'd like to focus more on the proximate immediate harms that the kinds of AI technologies we have today might pose. So if you take language models, the kind of technology that powers ChatGPT and other chatbots, there are harms that might result from regular use of these systems, and then there are harms that might result from malicious use. So regular use would be how you and I might use ChatGPT and other chatbots to do ordinary things. And there is a concern that these systems might reproduce and amplify biases that might include, for example, racist or sexist biases, generate toxic language, and also spread misinformation or inaccuracies, because these systems are known to, as researchers put it, hallucinate, namely make things up, and in some cases make up false citations. So if we start using these systems a bit like search engines or as a substitute to reliable sources of information, such as Wikipedia and reputable media outlets and other books, then we might end up getting some false information confidently asserted by these systems and taking it for granted. So we always have to be a little bit careful about that. And then there are the harms from malicious use, which might result from some bad actors using these systems for nefarious purposes. That would include disinformation on a mass scale. So you could imagine a bad actor using language models that are very capable of generating plausible text to automate the creation of fake news and propaganda, try to manipulate voters, for example. And this takes us into the medium-term future, because we're not quite there, but a potential concern would be language models being able to provide dangerous information and potentially illegal information that is not readily available on the internet for anyone to access, such as how to make a bomb, how to design a virus, engineer a deadly pandemic, etc. So currently, language models are capable of giving basic information along those lines, such as how to manufacture napalm, this kind of thing. But that's something that determined bad actor would probably be able to find on the internet without too much trouble. But as these systems keep getting better and better, there is a genuine concern that they might be able to generate instructions and provide information that is not readily available online. For example, in chemistry, there's some research showing that by getting better and better at solving chemical problems, answering chemical questions, and coming up with a step-by-step procedure to synthesize certain compounds. So as they get better, there is a concern that in the wrong hands, these systems might become quite powerful weapons, at least indirectly. And so people have been trying to mitigate these potential harms.
So yes, there's all these new drugs being developed, and you're probably familiar with this study that the scientists at Collaborations Pharmaceuticals, which normally focuses on drug discovery for rare diseases, ran an experiment for an international security conference to see if the AI designed for drug development could be misused. So by just adjusting its parameters to generate rather than avoid toxic substances, the researchers demonstrated that the AI could create 40,000 potentially deadly novel toxins. They gave the AI the task, and overnight, I think in less than 6 hours, it had generated a whole molecular library of potential toxic agents on par with VX and Novichok. So that, of course, is concerning. And you point to the fact that we're entrusting AI with more and more, and the responses that we receive via AI, even though we know it's an AI response, are sounding so convincing. You know, they've done a new study at Georgia State University, came out recently, and participants rated responses from AI doctors and human doctors without knowing the source, and favored, you know, overwhelmingly the AI doctor's response in terms of they seem to find them more caring, thorough, and relatable, maybe even more compassionate because maybe they have a bit more time and they have unlimited, you know, energy, whereas a real doctor might be pushed for time and could be a little bit blunt. So that kind of deceptive emotions that are put across through AI communications, as you point in your research, is convincing users to entrust more to it, to turn to it as a friend or someone that fills a space that's left in us through this epidemic of loneliness. So as we go to depend on them more, what are the risks to us?
Yes, I think that's a really important topic, especially because there are more and more commercial ventures that are trying to sell or market social AI companions, quote unquote, that would include even virtual romantic partners. So we've seen companies, startups like Replica and others kind of pioneer of this kind of product. And I am quite concerned about the short-term and long-term risks that results from this kind of product. Because I think what these companies are doing effectively is exploiting the human tendency for anthropomorphism, namely projecting human-like traits onto non-human things. In this case, chatbots that, in my opinion, currently do not have the kinds of mental states that we can confidently attribute to other human beings and to some non-human animals, including things like beliefs, desires, intentions, agency, etc. So it's quite concerning to see people reporting literally falling in love with AI companions and treating them as persons potentially worthy of rights, worthy of respect, and people that they could get attached to and that could make them do things that could eventually cause harm to humans themselves. So that's one concern. And we've already seen some very tragic stories involving human loss of life. So one example was, I think, a young man in Germany who took his own life after a conversation with a chatbot. Another experience was someone in the UK who, after such a conversation with a similar chatbot, ended up being convinced that he had to attempt to kill, I believe, the king of England, and was apprehended by the police. So these are just some of the very early stories, early tragedies that result from, indirectly at least, from interaction with this kind of technology. But in the wrong hands, when the systems are not readily capable to handle complex human emotions and are explicitly marketed to invite anthropomorphism, there is a concern that there would be a lot of potential human suffering resulting from that use. And then there is a further concern about how using these systems end up changing how humans interact with other humans themselves, right? If you interact with these social AI products, these so-called AI companions that are never antagonizing you, always agree with you, are always nice to you, but also are a bit like sycophants, always telling you what you want to hear. How does that change the way you interact with other humans? How does that change your tolerance for contradictory opinions, for other humans pushing back against your beliefs or actions? In particular, in the context of romantic relationships, if people fall in love with these systems and get used to this kind of one-way relationship, one-way interaction, where they're always have the last word and impose their own beliefs and preferences onto the relationship. How does that change how, as humans, we are capable of forming bonds and balanced and healthy relationships with other humans? So I don't want to succumb to a kind of moral panic about this technology, because I think every time a new technology develops, and we've seen that with video games, we've seen that with the internet, there's always a moral panic about the potential long-term implications. So I don't want to be too alarmist, but I do want to say that in some cases, new technologies do have detrimental effects. We can point to social media, for example, and its effects on the mental health of teenagers. There is mixed evidence there, but there is some consensus. So we don't know yet, but I say we have to be very careful in how we deploy this technology.
Yes, I just want very briefly on that point, I hadn't seen that evidence that video games don't lead to greater violence. I feel it's still open for susceptible individuals that can enact, you know, whose the goal of the game is to kill as many people as possible. But you could maybe expand upon that briefly for us.
So I'm not an expert in that topic, but I think there have been several meta-analyses that have looked at multiple studies conducted on violence and video games, concluding that there is no established statistically significant association between playing video games and actual violence in the real world. And I think that's somewhat consistent with something that's perhaps more generally known and established, namely that, you know, we are capable in engaging in acts of imagination involving very violent scenario. You just have to think of thousands of years of history of tragedy in literature, going back to ancient Greek tragedies and beyond. We humans love the thrill of thinking of very intense, dramatic stories, including a lot of violence. And this kind of act of make-believe is not associated necessarily to psychopathic threats or actual violence.
Yes. And you mentioned back there about, you know, a machine doesn't necessarily have desire, AI doesn't have desire. And people are discussing now whether we can program desire in a machine. Would that be enough of a safety measure? Or is programming desire certain limits, like moral limits, actually pose a greater danger? Are we kind of opening the box further?
Yes. So there is this general problem that researchers have talked about for some years now called the value alignment problem. And that's the problem of how do we ensure that the values of current and future AI systems are aligned with human values. Now, there are a lot of problems with that particular general formulation of the issue, because first of all, it's not clear that current systems have anything like values. I personally don't think that language models have desires, beliefs, and preferences in the same way that humans do. So that's the first issue here. And the second issue is that there is no such thing as a single set of human values. Humans are complicated. Human societies involve a huge diverse set of different perspectives and preferences and political beliefs and values. And so it would be foolish to think that we can just distill a single set of human values that we can all agree on, that we can straightforwardly align current and future AI systems with. So to just reformulate the problem a little bit in a way that I think is a little bit more tractable, I think the problem is steering the behavior of AI systems, remaining agnostic on whether or not they have anything like values. We can leave that aside and just focus on how they behave. So steering their behavior in a way that aligns with a minimal set of preferences that as a society, we can have a consensus about. So that might include not causing certain kinds of harms to humans, right? We don't want AI systems whose behavior might cause humans to kill themselves or to kill other humans. And generally, the AI industry has converged upon three norms that should be preferred to steer the behavior of AI systems, which are helpfulness, harmlessness, and honesty. So very briefly, the idea is that we want systems that are helpful, meaning that they do what we want them to do. So in the case of chatbots, we want chatbots to answer our questions in a way that is useful. The second criterion is harmlessness. Is avoiding to cause harm to humans, avoiding toxicity, avoiding dangerous advice, avoiding incitation of, you know, of dangerous acts, etc. And then the final criterion is honesty. So we want the systems to not make up facts and present incorrect information as factual, not make up citations when we ask them for medical advice, not give us dangerous advice. So that's connected to harmlessness as well. But we want these systems to not mislead us when we're asking for factual information. So this is the minimal set of norms that the AI industry has converged upon to align the behavior of AI systems. And part of the issue, just going back to your question, is that we're already seeing that in practice, the efforts that AI companies have deployed to achieve that goal are controversial, because we end up with these systems whose behavior does seem to exhibit some leaning, you could call it some bias, towards the values and preferences and beliefs of a certain segment of the population that might not reflect the values, preferences, and beliefs of other segments of the population. So, for example, there are studies showing that ChatGPT exhibits a broadly liberal bias that broadly aligns with the values of the liberal elites that are roughly the kind of socioeconomical background and community of the programmers and stakeholders that make these systems. And there's already some pushback against that. And that's a really complicated question. Do we end up with fragmented models, a fragmented AI system, where each different community that has different sets of norms and values have their own AI chatbot that reflects their own values? And we might end up with echo chambers, a bit like we've had with social media, where conservatives have their own version of reality reflected by their own chatbots, and liberals have their own, et cetera, and different countries, different cultures have their own different identity-laden communities? Or do we try to square the circle and have a just single hegemonical chatbots like ChatGPT that everyone uses? But then how do we reconcile that with the conflicts between different communities' values? And how do we make these systems at the same time safe, but also appealing to the greater number of people?
Exactly. I'm glad that you mentioned, you know, AI companies, because, and this is something I don't really know about, but I mean, just following the news, Mark Zuckerberg said Meta wants to be the leading AI company in the world and should invest significantly more over the coming years to build even more advanced models. I mean, we already know how the reach of Meta, which is, you know, a few billion, I think the coverage of Meta, which is just more than any country, right? And yet there's the regulations, although we're kind of seeing the beginnings of it, they're not strong enough. And then I see Microsoft, and I'm just, these are just investing over 2 billion in cloud and AI infrastructure in Spain, similar amount, over 3 billion in Germany, in several countries, in Malaysia, you know, over 2 billion in all these areas. So what does that mean in terms of talking about reinforcing bias? And they'll just have everything. So what do we do to protect ourselves and how to customize it? And is there any way that we can really avoid it?
Yeah, that's a very interesting and complicated question, because I do agree that these very large companies developing these huge language models that end up having a quasi-monopoly on the AI sector. So that would include certainly systems like ChatGPT that many, many people use and for many people represents AI in general. That's how many people have been exposed to recent developments in AI. It's through this product from OpenAI. That gives companies like OpenAI and indirectly Microsoft, who has invested a lot of money in OpenAI, a lot of power through this new medium that previously didn't exist. Of course, these companies already have a lot of power through other products and platforms, including social media. But certainly, the rise of chatbots and language models introduced this new vector, potentially that could lead to new ways to influence a certain segment of the population and potential customers. So we probably want to be careful about resisting potential monopolies here and making sure that all stakeholders can have a say in how should be developed or should not be developed, and also have some involvement at all stages of development, including these complicated questions about how do we want these systems to be aligned and with whose values should we align them. Here, we don't want companies to have a monopoly on this kind of discussion. We want to involve, presumably, everyone in a more democratic process. So regulation has a role to play in that. Currently, there is a lot of enthusiasm about open source language models. Software generally refers to software whose code is available, readily available for anyone to use or modify or compile on their own computers. And it's a little bit of a misnomer when it comes to language models. Are these, as I mentioned early on, these artificial neural networks trained from a lot of text data. And once they're trained, there is this artifact language model, which is this neural network that can be deployed in platforms like ChatGPT. And it has a lot of internal parameters, or that are also called the weights of the neural network, which are the connections between the artificial neurons of the network. And OpenAI, for example, doesn't give access to the weights of ChatGPT. It is only served through their platform, ChatGPT, and through their API that customers can use, but customers can't modify ChatGPT. And now there is a lot of enthusiasm for models that, unlike ChatGPT or the underlying models, can be modified. So sometimes they're called open source models. Perhaps a better term would be open weights models, because you can download the weights on your computer locally and you can fine tune the model to your own preference. You can modify it to change its behavior in ways that you find useful. So that's a potential avenue to resist the monopoly of kind of monolithical vision of big companies like OpenAI by having models that everyone can tinker with, modify, and deploy for their own custom purposes. Meta has been at the forefront to train and release in open weights some language models. And of course, one also has to always wonder how that benefits them as a company. They wouldn't do that if it wasn't aligned with their own commercial interests. And in that case, it seems that perhaps what their strategy is what some people call commoditizing your complement. So in that case, Meta is in the business of making social media products, and it's an ad company that profits from content creation on social media. So their complement, namely the other way in which people might create content is in the future, is AI, because AI could generate images and text, etc. So the rise of generative AI could be a threat to Meta's business model, which centrally revolves around human-created content. So one could see Meta's strategy as a way to commoditize their complement, namely make language models dirt cheap and ubiquitous such that companies no longer have a monopoly on that. And therefore, there is no single concurrent, no single big company, OpenAI or Microsoft or Anthropic and others, that could rise to take, to rob Meta of their core business models. But the end result is that people do have now some models they can download on their computer that are not quite as good as the best version of GPT, of ChatGPT so far. They can fine-tune them to their own liking. And so we are going to see a lot more custom models in the future.
That's encouraging. It's also finding the time for the average person who's going to it for convenience. You know, it's all that fine print, like, and the cookies and all these things that if you have time to untick all the boxes. I want to ask you about, when do you think we'll have artificial general intelligence, you know, and what we have to do to protect ourselves?
So I'm a little skeptical about the notion of artificial general intelligence or AGI, at least as it's often used in the AI industry by companies like OpenAI. If you read some of the statements that OpenAI has released over the past couple of years, they often present AGI, artificial general intelligence, as a singular goalpost threshold that one day we might pass and we might, there's a specific moment where we achieve AGI. But a little ill-defined and at least vague, right? So what does this term general mean? I think it's context dependent. So think of the phrase tall building. A tall building in New York doesn't mean the same thing as a tall building in a small town in Italy. What is a tall building in that small town will not be a tall building in New York. And I think AGI or general intelligence is a bit like that. So in some respect, the intelligence of a rat is fairly general. A rat is capable of solving problems in novel environments. There are plenty of studies showing rats can solve mazes in new mazes they haven't been exposed to before, for example. So the intelligence of a rat is, of course, very limited to compared to that of a human and presumably far less general and yet also general in some respect. Human intelligence, on the other hand, can seem very general, but even human intelligence is also constrained in some ways as well. We have evolved to solve specific kinds of problems that are tied to the environment we've evolved in and the kinds of challenges we have to survive and reproduce and ensure the continuation of the species. So there is no such thing as a universally general intelligence. Intelligence is always shaped and constrained by the environment of the system we are calling intelligent and the kinds of problems that are relevant to that environment. So AGI, well, I think it's perhaps more useful to break down intelligence into different cognitive capacities and ask ourselves how robust, how flexible AI systems' competence with respect to these different capacities, right? So think about reasoning, for example. Can AI systems reason about the same range of problems that humans can reason about? And can they do so as efficiently as humans do? And if we break down things in this way, it's very unlikely that there will be a singular moment where we can say, quote unquote, AGI has been achieved. Rather, there will be some milestones in different domains that over time are going to amount to systems that might feel more competent than humans in these domains, in the sense that they might be more reliable, more effective in solving certain kinds of problems. So I'm not necessarily saying that we will never have systems that surpass human beings in terms of their competence and cognitive capacities in a lot of different domains that we care about. But I'm saying that it's unlikely to be achieved through a singular breakthrough that leads to a singular moment where we can say something like AGI has been achieved. It's going to be more of a gradual process that's going to encompass lots of different domains on which we can track the progress of AI.
My name is Hannah Lumi. I study communications, creative writing, and philosophy in New York City. There are no overall set of human values that encompass the entirety of human society. Raphael eloquently puts into perspective the complexity of humanity and the different perspectives we all have. AI and humanity both are incredibly environment sensitive. So given these technological advances in the digital era we find ourselves in, including AI, how do we protect ourselves? How do we keep the authenticity of human interaction?
utilizing AI in a productive way aligned with human values. Is it possible? Keeping in mind the goal of helpfulness, harmlessness, and honesty, the most we can do is adapt to our environment, utilizing these artificial intellectual tools for good. Protecting our authenticity in art, education, linguistics, human interaction, etc., the most we can hope for is attempting to mitigate this unknown territory, keeping in mind what we derive our sense of purpose from. In fact, Aristotle once wrote that knowing yourself is the beginning of all wisdom, and it is the mark of an educated person to search for the same kind of clarity in each topic to the extent that the nature of the matter accepts it. And I hope that our collective creative process will be enhanced, not deterred, from this cultivation of AI. Now, back to the interview.
And on that point of what the difference between intelligence and sentience and the consciousness, I do want to focus on the creativity in AI. Then I have another question about fMRI and unlocking. We can mind read now with AI on this. But on this point of creativity, I'm an artist. I write fiction. And anyone I've spoken to, whether it's filmmakers, dancers, you know, or the whole gamut and also creativity in the sciences, they've always spoken about they can't identify where their ideas come from, or they call it the flow state, or they call it, you know, when they accessed something that defines them as an artist, it wasn't coming from them. And they're not talking with false humility. They're just talking about something else takes over. It's a kind of automaticity. And that seems quite close, even though there's not a human story behind it. There's a multiple human stories in terms of everything that AI has scraped in order to give responses so quickly or generate images or now, you know, editing film and these kind of things. How is that really different? Besides the lack of the human story, how is that different than something that just seems to come out of you without thinking?
That's a really interesting question, because often when people talk about creativity and AI, the kind of attitude people might have is that human creativity is unique and is radically unlike an automated process that we could realize in a computer program. But I agree with you that when you talk to a lot of human artists and creators, they might actually describe a process that in their mind feels a little bit like something taking over their own intentionality and something that almost happens on its own, which is really intriguing because it goes against what how most people think about creativity, especially in comparison to in relation to how computers work. What I would say is that creativity is a polysemous term that can mean different things. So one thing we can mean when we ask whether computers and AI can be creative in the way humans are is we could ask a question about the creativity of the outputs of computer programs and AI. So generally, when philosophers think about this kind of question, they boil down the creativity of outputs to two things: whether the outputs of a system are sufficiently novel compared to whatever they've seen before, and whether these outputs are valuable in a relevant way. So for example, when it comes to art, we want artistic creations to be interesting in a certain sense, right? I mean, we don't have to fully flesh out what that means. That would mean different things to different people. Perhaps some people care about certain aesthetics. Other people care about how the art makes them think. But in any case, there are normative judgments associated to how we appraise artistic creations, and we want them to be valuable in a certain way. So with respect to outputs, the question is, are the outputs of AI sufficiently novel and sufficiently valuable to count as creative outputs? And I personally would say, at least for some of these outputs, not all of them, of course, for some of them, I would say, yes, I think that we can find some outputs of generative AI systems that tick these boxes in the sense that they are sufficiently different from anything that was in the training data of the systems to count as novel in the relevant sense. And they are also arguably valuable that a lot of people seem to find them interesting, whether they find them beautiful or they find them thought-provoking, etc. I'm not saying that all or even the majority of the outputs of generative AI systems will be like that. So that's the outputs. And there is a different notion of creativity that's tied to the process itself, the process of creation. And when we talk about this process of creation with humans, often people seem to think that what's important is the intention of the human creator. They must have some kind of vision or some kind of intention to create and to realize that vision. And that's something that's arguably is missing from current AI technology. There is no intention to create anything. The intention comes from the humans who use these systems as tools to create things. But there is no original intention in the system itself. So in that sense, I would say AI can be creative in the sense that its outputs can be creative, but the process of creation itself is not creative, or is only creative through the intentions that humans impose onto the AI systems they use.
I agree. We just have to, definitely, it can be experienced as that. And then at some point, maybe if we're accepting it into our models, I don't accept it into, because I just don't want to feed it anymore. But I understand that people are working with it. But I think it's really about ultimately, then the question is just about valuing. It's not completely artificial intelligence. At some point down the line, it was human intelligence and human creativity that fed these models. And we're just going to have an endless loop. We do base art on tropes, but you know, it's inevitable. There are certain plots, images do get repeated, but how do we value those original human creators who have become source material?
Yeah, that's definitely a very important and pressing question about plagiarism. What about exploitation of the work and vision and labor of human artists whose outputs become part of the training data of these AI systems? And how do we address this problem in the right way, in a way that doesn't wrong any stakeholder, be it humans, artists, engineers, companies, and society at large? That's a very difficult question. I don't have the answer to that question. There have been proposals, for example, to remunerate human artists whose artworks, whose outputs were part of the training data of these systems, and also to make sure that there's a way for them to opt out of having their works included in the training data of these systems. I think these are definitely proposals that constitute a step in the right direction if we don't want to, you know, make the creation of these AI systems illegal altogether. These are ways to perhaps reconcile technological innovation with fair treatment and fair remuneration of human artists. But these are complicated discussions, and I don't yet know how we can, as a society, move forward to mitigate this kind of dynamic where human artists might find themselves exploited, but also out of work as well, as people tend to rely more and more on these algorithms instead of appealing to human workers and human artists.
On that point, mind reading is now possible, or you know, somewhat possible. They say AI makes a non-invasive mind reading possible by turning thoughts into text. They've done these tests on functional magnetic resource imaging, fMRI, that technique for measuring and mapping brain activity. Scan data that can even predict language, you know, on a sentence level. I'm sure you've seen some of this. How do these breakthroughs in AI-based mind reading technology challenge traditional notions of language origins and the boundaries of the extended mind theory?
So there are a lot of different issues there that we could disentangle. So one is that there is indeed this line of research that tries to decode from brain imaging data obtained, for example, from fMRI, what subjects are seeing, so what kind of images they are looking at, or what they are reading, or what they are even thinking. And we should be clear that this is not the kind of magical technology one might think about when thinking about mind reading. It's a very complex and involved setup that involves human participants coming into the lab, being placed into an fMRI scanner, having their brain scanned while they look at a bunch of different images or sentences, for example, collecting a large data set and then training a model on that data set of stimuli plus brain imaging data to try to predict when the specific human subject is looking at specific images or sentences, for example. This is a very far cry from being able to read what's in the mind of a random individual who would come into the fMRI scanner without having collected all of this data before, let alone a random person in the street reading their mind. So I just want to be clear that when we're talking about mind reading here, it's still very far from the kind of sci-fi technology people might be imagining. But you touched on another very interesting question, which is, what might we learn from recent developments in AI about how humans learn and process language? Because we have these language models that learn from a lot of text, and after learning from all that text, are capable of generating language in a very compelling way, generating full sentences, even full paragraphs that are perfectly grammatically coherent and make good sense to us. These systems, when they learn, and they learn from next word prediction. So what they do to learn automatically from data is they sample millions of times or billions of times some sequences of texts scraped from the internet, and they try to predict what is the word that follows this sequence. So they play this next word prediction game, And by playing this game, they get better and better at generating words. And so then once they get really good at that, they can just generate whole paragraphs of text word by word. So we might think, well, maybe there's something to be learned about how these systems learn language that we could apply to research on language acquisition in humans. And the full story is a little bit more complicated because, of course, humans don't learn from the same kind of data as language models learn from. Language models learn from this internet scraped data that includes New York Times articles, blog posts, as well as, you know, thousands of books, but also a bunch of programming code and so on. That's very different from the kind of linguistic input that children learn from, which is child-directed speech from parents and relatives that is much simpler linguistically, but also orders of magnitude less sentences than language models learn from. So we can draw a direct inference from what language models learn from and how children learn, because children don't learn from written text, but learn from auditory signals and also from visual signals that include very different information. That said, there is a lot of interesting research trying to train smaller language models on a more ecologically valid data set, that is data similar to the kind of input that a child might receive when they're learning language. So what you can do, for example, is you can literally strap head-mounted camera on a young child's head for a few hours every day and record the stream from the camera, including whatever auditory information the child has access to, which would include any language spoken around the child or directed at the child. And then you can transcribe that and use that data set to train a language model on child-directed speech, on the kind of directed speech that a real human infant would have received during their development. And if you can train a model on that and the model is capable of learning the rules of grammar and learning to speak like a child, then we can draw stronger inferences about how children learn language by studying how these artificial models are learning from child-directed speech. And that might eventually go some way towards advancing debates about what scientists and philosophers call nativism versus empiricism with respect to language acquisition. So the nature-nurture debate. Are we born with a universal innate grammar that enables us to learn the rules of language, as linguists like Noam Chomsky have argued? Or can we learn the rules of language? Can we learn language and its grammatical rules just from raw data, just from hearing, being exposed to language as children? If these language models manage to learn how to use language in the way children do, then that might put some pressure on the nativist claim that there is this innate component to language learning that involves this language-specific knowledge that is part of our DNA, as opposed to just learning that from exposure to language.
I think that's really fascinating. I don't know who's putting that forward. And I also raises interesting questions about what children, and whether they're in developing nations, what parents would put for their child for a test like that, because already I think you have deep concerns as well. And I know in Australia and, of course, in France recently, public schools aren't allowing mobile phones until a certain age. And that's just mobile phones, which seems like the starter gateway drug to these other things. And I have concerns, I think we all do, about young people. They're just starting out and they're already being surveilled. So I have concerns for those children who might be part of this. I do want to touch on some other core questions about AI-dominated age, what your reflections are on the future of work and education. It seems like the future of education seems very autodidactic. You know, what do you think schools would look like in 10, 15 years? What can we do to prepare young people for the future of work?
That's a really important question. And I also don't have a completely straightforward answer, because I think this is something that everyone involved is still actively thinking through. I certainly know that as a professor and educator, I have a lot of these discussions with my colleagues. In fact, just today I had a department meeting in my university where we're discussing the impact of AI on teaching and how we can adapt both to mitigate the risks of unfair assessment and students cheating, but also to harness this technology in the right ways to evolve the way in which we teach. My thinking on this is that I don't think universities and school will disappear, be replaced by this kind of AI-enabled autodidactic process. any more than, say, YouTube has replaced universities. I think there will always be a place for universities. And the analogy I would say is a bit like the difference between trying to learn a language exclusively through Duolingo and actually learning a language through immersion into a linguistic community. Anyone who is serious about learning languages will tell you that nothing will replace actual immersion in a linguistic community. And Duolingo does not compare. It could be useful to learn a vocabulary, for example, but it will not replace the other important aspects of learning language. And I think learning in general can be like that. Having actual immersion in an educational context at the university and interactions with educators, with a teacher, with a professor, this back and forth of writing essays or asking questions and receiving feedback and being guided by an actual human being. I think people will always value that. At least I hope so. But that's not to say that AI would not have an important role to play. And in fact, I think educators will need to adapt and harness some of these tools for good. For example, one thing I've started doing with some of my students when it's appropriate, and I've done that actually when I taught the first class on the philosophy of AI at Columbia University, is to have some students actively use language models to generate arguments for and against a particular claim, and then in class assess the strength of these generated arguments and tear them apart together or see whether we can poke holes in them. So that's a way to use AI-related technology, not as a substitute for critical thinking, but instead precisely as a way to stimulate the students' critical thinking skills by having them think about the outputs of these systems and realize also their weaknesses. So I think that's one potential way if we can harness the systems and potentially in the process make learning enjoyable and interactive in a way that perhaps wouldn't be the case without using these tools. So I think they can hopefully be used in a productive, constructive way that doesn't take away from the student's learning process. But I don't think they will replace entirely the kind of education that can be received from being immersed in a university context.
Yeah, we do need that slow reflection at some stage and that interpretation, critical thinking. And you've spoken about mistrust and, you know, deepfakes. And so what are reflections on the future of journalism in a post-truth world? I mean, we have all this erosion of trust in institutions. What kind of measures can be taken to foster a robust and ethical fourth estate? Journalism is a business that's really ailing.
Yes, journalists, as they have always had a critical role to play in society, will have a critical role to play in the society of the future, perhaps even more important, as you say, because we will live in an age where any kind of not just article, but also image and video can be manufactured. So having some kind of credentialed and very verifiable testimony through journalistic practice will be very important. So I think journalists will have a key role to play. They already do. I would just like to mention that while misinformation or disinformation certainly is a big concern and can be potentiated by generative AI, there's also a lot of research showing, perhaps somewhat counterintuitively, that it is not as big a problem as we tend to think, in the sense that there are studies showing that people are actually overall quite good at discriminating between disinformation and accurate information. So we don't give enough credit to our own capacity to do that. I mean, generally, people tend to exempt themselves from the kind of individual that might be prone to believing disinformation and think, oh, but these other people, you know, perhaps in a different political camp, they are gullible, they are susceptible to believing in conspiracy theories or disinformation. But again, the reality of it is that the kinds of people who do engage with this kind of information and do truly believe it, it tends to be a very specific demographic in terms of their dispositions, you know, personality traits and cognitive styles and the dispositions to engage with information in a certain way. But it's a very small minority compared to the general population. So by and large, people do have the ability to discriminate between reliable and unreliable sources of information. And the second component of this slight pushback against the mainstream narrative is that there's also evidence that by and large, mainstream media is a very reliable source of information. It's common these days to attack mainstream media as being unduly biased or unreliable. And the truth is, by and large, mainstream media outlets are quite reliable if you look at the actual evidence. And they are judged quite trustworthy by the majority of people. So I think they will continue to have this vital role in providing, if not a ground truth, at least some kind of reliable perspective on current events in the age of generative AI. And their role might only grow more important as this kind of technology evolves. But I just would like to emphasize that some of the persistent narratives about the misinformation crisis in a post-truth world are a little bit overblown in light of the evidence.
Oh, that's good to know. And I kind of heard whisperings there that there is a certain flow of misinformation. And as AI takes more grip of our systems, that maybe that could inspire a resurgence of legacy journalism and legacy media. So that would be wonderful, because I think it takes a lot of time to sift through the BS, you know?
Absolutely.
Hi, Raphael.
Hi.
So I'm considering pursuing a master's in philosophy. I have some discussion questions about specifically ethical theory and AI. So just jumping to virtue ethics, Aristotle concludes that the telos or aim of human existence is virtue and practical reason. Do you think it's possible to achieve eudaimonia or true happiness in a world which is easily constructed to fit an artificial purpose?
That's a very deep question. I think it depends exactly on what one means by artificial purpose. So I don't necessarily think that the advent of AI technology will rob us of the kinds of things we use to derive our sense of purpose from. There are many different things people derive a sense of purpose from, whether it is the kinds of hobbies we have, whether it's art, whether it's things we enjoy doing, careers, family, relationships, etc., religion. All of these things, I think, will still remain things that human beings derive a sense of purpose from, and things that can make their lives meaningful, even in an age where AI becomes increasingly good. And in fact, if you take the utopian view on this, which I don't necessarily share, but the utopian perspective on this is that AI, by getting better, will eventually automate most, if not all, jobs. And in this utopian vision, then resources can be evenly distributed amongst people who no longer have to work. And we might end up in that post-scarcity utopia where we can focus on the things that bring us value and meaning, like making art and nurturing relationships, etc., instead of slaving away at work. Now, of course, unfortunately, in a capitalist society, I'm not so sure that this is necessarily the future that we're heading towards. It's, as we talked about earlier, it's very likely that a few tech giants might concentrate a lot of the power that derives from the deployment of AI and the automation of various professions through AI. But I also think it's unlikely that humans stop working altogether. Rather, what will probably happen is that jobs will just transform and evolve in the age of AI, and almost all professions will involve using AI in the loop in some way as a tool. But again, I think, you know, the traditional sources of meaning and value that humans have had for a long time, hobbies, arts, family, relationships, perhaps religion, etc., these will very much remain there for humans to derive value from.
Yeah. And it goes into what Mia was saying earlier about just like creativity. But in terms of, in a Kantian sense, more exactly that which pertains to the categorical imperative. I was thinking about this. What do you think Kant would personally say about artificial intelligence in relation to the test of universalizability? So with the creation and use of AI as the universal maxim here.
So it's a complicated question. And to give a full answer, we need to delve deep into Kantian ethics, which we can't really do on this podcast. But just for the listeners, to simplify a lot, Kant believed that certain behaviors, for example, lying, morally reprehensible, because if everyone behaved like that, if everyone lied, well, obviously, we'd be in trouble because society could not be sustained and no one could trust anyone. And so the way in which ethical theories are usually carved out, Kant is a proponent of deontologism, and argued that there are certain maxims or moral rules that we ought to abide by, and these should be absolute, such as not lying to someone else. And these are not context sensitive and not context dependent. These are not the kinds of moral precepts that are dependent on the particular context in which they are applied. So they're absolute, they apply everywhere at all times. Now, the way in which most AI researchers think about AI ethics is usually, and you might say perhaps disproportionately, informed by a different way of thinking about ethics, which is the utilitarian framework, or more broadly, what philosophers call the consequentialist framework. Whether or not something is morally permissible depends on its consequences. Whether or not one should be morally allowed to perform a certain act depends on the consequence of that act, which will be context sensitive, unlike the Kantian maxims. So that is reflected in the way we are aligning the behavior of AI systems, these norms of helpfulness, harmlessness, and honesty. These, in the way in which they are embedded in the techniques to steer the behavior of language models and chatbots like ChatGPT, these are context sensitive. So what will be deemed harmless or harmful, or honest or dishonest, or helpful or unhelpful in a particular context depends on specifically what the user has passed as inputs to the language model, the specific phrasing of the user input or the user prompt, which in turn will determine how the model should respond. And we don't really have any equivalent of these Kantian absolute maxims or moral imperatives when it comes to the kinds of ethical guardrail we impose on current system. And in fact, you could argue that's a problem because there is currently no way to reliably and absolutely make a language model behave in a way that respects a specific absolute maxim, such as never say a particular thing. There are these techniques called adversarial attacks that will enable the bad actor to force a language model to spit out certain things that are deemed problematic. And we currently don't have a reliable techniques to enforce absolute rules in these systems in the way that you might want to in a Kantian framework, to make them absolutely refuse in all cases to output that kind of language. That's something that you could relate to some of these discussions about Kantian ethics.
As you reflect on the future education, the importance of the arts, and the kind of world we're leaving for the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Before I decided to become a philosopher, I wanted to become a filmmaker. And in my education in France, where I'm originally from, there was a lot of emphasis placed on the humanities and art. And I think it's something I've taken with me, even though these days I focus on topics that can be quite technical and quite dry. If you read my papers, they're quite technical and dry in this way. But I still have a deep passion for the arts. And when it comes to our future, I am of two minds about the role that AI will play in how we interact with arts. So perhaps we could add on that note, because on the one hand, I think they have tremendous potential to supercharge human creativity. Going back to my first love of cinema, there are various young filmmakers currently who are experimenting with AI systems to generate shots, generate short videos, and use this creatively. And I think there is a tremendous potential there to usher in a new renaissance of surrealist cinema, where we can generate images, make shots that could never have been made with a traditional camera, certainly not without a huge budget. And so potentially that could enable some very creative people who would never have gotten a green light from a big studio or the money to realize their artistic vision, to make that artistic vision a reality. And I think that's very exciting. So lowering the barrier to entry to artistic creation is something I'm excited about. On the other hand, of course, there are the various issues we've raised about the potential for plagiarism, for exploiting human artists, but also concerns about de-skilling people gradually using artistic skills because we have these tools available, and also concerns about the homogenization of taste. How is AI going to influence the kind of art and generally content entertainment we like to consume? How does engagement with AI-generated artifacts change the way we relate to art? I think it could come with good and bad, and it could change and homogenize tastes and preferences and the little quirks we have in the way we engage with music, video, and literature in nefarious ways. But it could also, on the other hand, again, supercharge creativity. So that's perhaps the one thing I'd like to say about the future and future generation. I hope that these new technologies are used to empower human creativity and human flourishing instead of stifling it.
Exactly. It could go two ways. So your research is very important so that we consider the paths we don't want to follow, that we can bold and empower all creatives or all people without devaluing the human contributions to creativity. So thank you, Raphael Millier, for your important research into the philosophy of artificial intelligence, cognitive science, existential risk, language, and reasoning. By helping us understand what we value, where we're going, we can consider possible outcomes and what we should do to ensure a positive future. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thanks for having me.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Hannah Lumi with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Hannah Lumi. Associate text editor was Sophia Reeser. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production supported by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadoulis and performed by the Athenian Trio.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.